Hear the question clearly.
I think the second one was regarding suicide bombings, especially those that are targeted at civilians, and in trying to justify those to especially non-Muslims. The first one I didn't quite
You gave an explanation why the Israelis have come back to the Holy Land. It was to fulfill their obligation, mission obligation, to Allah. Now, doesn't this kind of justify the existence of the state of Israel?
Okay, I understand both questions now. I'm sorry, there's some type of maybe static. From my position here, I can't hear the question very good. But I understood, the brother here paraphrased you, and I think I understand the gist of your questions. First of all, the Israelis now, their return to the occupied territories, to the Holy Land, was not done in accordance with scripture and revelation. They were given the opportunity to enter that land according to scripture and revelation thousands of years ago. They balked at it, they hesitated, they refrained, and then they refused. إِنَّ فِيهَا قَوْمًا جَبَّارِينَ. And then they told Musa, اِذْهَبْ أَنْتَ وَرَبُّكَ فَقَاتِلَا إِنَّهَا هُنَا قَاعِدُونَ. They said, if you want to do any warfare, O Moses, then you go and you and your brother, you can do all the battling and warring that you want. We're staying right here. We're not moving in that direction. So the religious Jews will tell you that because of this and other events peculiar to their history, that they have to live in a time of atonement in which the real state of the Mosaic law or the Israel, the real Israel, not this phony thing that exists now, will only come with the advent of the Messiah, who according to them has never come, and so they are in anticipation of him. These Zionists who came and reclaimed that area did so not on the basis of scripture or on the basis of heavenly laws, but they did so on the basis of racism, on the basis of what may be called secular or satanic laws. So they have no right to be there. We have the right to be there, except what impedes our right to be there is the force that they have established there that supersedes our military forces, and also our veering away from the instructions, what I was trying to refer to, the militarized psychology and mentality that we need to make a thrust into that land and reclaim our rights and the heavenly laws that should be applied there. So that's question number one. Question number two, pertaining to suicide, what is called or used to be called suicide operations. More recently, they're trying to give it the name homicidal operations. There are no Muslims in Palestine who are targeting civilians. All Muslims who strap themselves with explosives are targeting military personnel. They don't have any militaries, they don't have any delivery system. Muslims don't have F-16s, they don't have tanks. Yes, Arafat himself, he didn't have a military around him. These were Boy Scouts. Yes, Arafat has some 35,000 Boy Scouts around him. They don't have half tracks, they don't have armored personnel carriers. They may have some jeeps, they may have some vehicles, but that's about it. And all civilians have those and pistols. That's not a military force. So knowing this, and with the cumulative violence and injustice done to the Palestinian population throughout all of these years, And with the Oslo, what is called the Oslo peace process, winding up with more misery, more unemployment, more economic hardships, more frustrations that the Palestinians have been suffering from, they finally found out that the best thing to do is to fight against the Israelis. And they realized, well, if we're going to fight against them, how are we going to do this? We don't have the instruments to fight against them. See, you have to pause for a minute and consider the conditions that the Palestinians are in. The Palestinians are not like in South Lebanon, where there was, as limited as it was, but still, there was a line of ammunition open to the combatants, the Muslim combatants in South Lebanon. The Palestinians don't have that. The best they have is smuggled weapons or arms that they may manage to get from different sources. And that's after very much difficulty. And when they get this, how are they going to use it against their enemy? Now, if they were given military means, if they had tanks and they had warplanes and they had the rest of these military gadgets and didn't use it, then we could come and say, hey, wait a minute, what's going on here? They have another way to fight, but they choose to fight dirty. They don't have another way to fight. So their choice at fighting is the only choice, and that is they strip themselves of these explosives and they go out. They go out and seek a military target. Now you tell me, well, a pizzeria is not a military base. And I tell you, you're right. A pizzeria is not a military base. But in that pizzeria, are there military personnel? Yes, there are. And does a Palestinian have a right to target military personnel? Yes, he or she does. Do they do that? Yes, they do that. As a consequence, are there civilian casualties? Yes, there are civilian casualties. But the civilians were not the target. And when there's civilian casualties on our side, what do they call it? Collateral damage. And when there's civilian targets on their side, we call it collateral damage. And that's it. Well, you know, no one really knows how long these occupation forces are going to stay in Afghanistan. No one gave them the permission to be there, obviously. Remember before the United States used to go through the United Nations to do things? If it wanted to go somewhere in the world, it sort of, you know, remember the war against Iraq in 1991 and how they got the United Nations involved in this and other international organizations. But now the United States just went in there. Didn't need any permission. See, when you're a hyperpower like the United States, when a superpower no longer knows its limits, it feels like it can do whatever it wants to do. And this is one of those cases where it feels like it can go into Afghanistan, bring in whoever wants to come with it, such as the British, the Canadians, the Australians, and whoever else, with whatever amount of troops they volunteer to send over there, and stay there until they're goals are accomplished. What are their goals? I think I referred to that in the presentation. They want to destroy the nuclear capability in Pakistan. They want to, you see, these are oil men in the White House and around the White House now. Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld. This is big oil companies at work. They found out that Kazakhstan alone has $4 trillion worth of oil. or is it 4 trillion barrels of oil? And so they want that oil. They've advanced to the Kazakhstan government $3.5 billion to officials on the high levels. They've sunk in $35 billion for building a petroleum infrastructure in that area. They don't want all of that to go to waste by some Muslims coming to rule somehow in that part of the world to threaten their interests. So they are there to finish this mission of denuclearizing Pakistan, of getting a hold of the petroleum, they call it the second Persian Gulf, around the Caspian Sea in Central Asia. And number three, to surround the Islamic power base in Iran and try to impress on it that it should behave just like every other nation state in the world. Behave itself, don't get involved in Middle Eastern, such as the Palestinian issue and all of this, you know, don't get involved in all of that, etc. And if these, when these are accomplished, whether it's according to the United States, now they're talking about a war that's in the twilight zone. This can go on for an indefinite time. It may not even end in our lifetime. This is what they're telling us from the highest American officials. And this can go on indefinitely. So we don't know. But we know that these are their objectives. And if they're moving in the direction of achieving their objectives and they think they're making gains, they will want to stay there more. But if they begin to realize that they're not going anywhere, there are American servicemen coming back in coffins, Muslims are opposed to the United States even more 2 years from now, 4 years from now. If they see that the momentum is against them, then they'll begin to lose interest in staying there. That's a good question, and we tried to answer it yesterday, and it comes up today, and I think it's going to keep on coming up. But anyways, Muslims or the first generation who has gone to the West, whether it's the United States or Britain or anywhere else, We are led to believe when we are, I was born in the United States. I didn't go to the United States from anywhere else. So I have no choice. I don't know how what you were born here just like me, born in the West or whatever. But I speak to the fact that Muslims who are born in the West, whether it's Britain or the United States or any other country, we should not for one moment think that we are lesser Americans or British or whatever than the rest of the people are. They want us to believe that. You see, no one asks, I don't know here in Britain, but I'll tell you in the United States, no one comes to a Polish person and says, what's your origin? Or comes to a German and tells him, originally, where are you from? But when they see me, you know, I have a little beard like this most of the time. Sometimes it's a little bigger than this. And they look at me, and it's very interesting the type of questions sometimes you get. So, sometimes, they, especially when they know your name. If they don't know my name and I'm talking, they're very reserved because, believe it or not, many times they think I'm a Jew. So, and this is very, it comes out very clear when I'm with my family, because my wife is wearing the full hijab and my daughters, I have three daughters and one boy. So the whole family is screaming out, we're Muslims, you know? So, when we go to a department store, I go to that, I've been there before without my family, and I'm treated like I'm some type of, you know, very important person. If they make a mistake with me, they apologize and all this. Then when I bring my family along, the same people behave exactly the opposite. They become like ferocious, aggressive, condescending. Wait, what happened here? I mean, we're the same people. So they, and some of these characters, they ask you when they know your name and your, some of your identity, they ask you, where are you from? I say, I'm from Michigan. You know, I live in the Washington, D.C. area, and they ask, and Michigan is another state, they ask, where are you from? I say, I'm from Michigan. And that blows their mind. They expect me to say, oh, I'm from, and then, and whatever's on their mind, Egypt or Turkey or Iran or something else. I don't know what's on their mind, but that's what they expect, something along those lines. And then when they hear that, then they take a moment, they step back and hesitate. So that what they're trying to do is place us in a position of being lesser civilians than they are. No one should accept that. That's number one. Number two, because of who we are, especially the first generation immigrants, people who have come to the West and gained the citizenship of the West, I think it doesn't occur to second and third generation Muslims who are born in the West, but this occurs with the newcomers who really want this American dream and they really want to make it and they don't want to mess around. So they say, yeah, we should get involved in politics, and the best way to do that is we have to register as Republicans and Democrats. What it would be here, the Labor Party and the Conservative Party. We have to register and then vote. And you know, get into, no, we don't have to do that. There are many Americans who refuse to be Republicans and Democrats. They are in the opposition. We should feel stronger about this political opposition than anyone else. Especially when it comes to all of these issues that we have around that they want solutions to. These issues come around every time there's a major election. They begin to speak about unemployment. They begin to speak about securing health insurance for everyone. Maybe your health insurance here is better than ours in the U.S. But the U.S., I think, in all of the first world, only South Africa is worse than the U.S. as far as health insurance is concerned, because there's about 50 million Americans who don't have health insurance. That's a lot of people. So this is one of the issues that come up. The other issue comes out is drugs, addiction, crime in the neighborhoods, racism. The ghettos and the slums and this, all of these issues have to be solved. How do we solve this as an Islamic party, as an Islamic political force that is opposed to the political structure that they have? We can be just as American and more American than those who are Democrats and Republicans by presenting real Islamic solutions to real civic problems. This is where our concentration should be, and we should feel very strong about that. Not by going and having lobbies and saying, hey, Republicans, you should understand what we're all about. Or, hey, Democrats, you know, we're Democrats also, and we can contribute to your program. Look, we can bring you some money. Here's a check for Hillary Clinton. And then Hillary Clinton sends it back to the Muslim donor. I don't want your money. I think, you know, it's very clear that Muslims should begin to mature in the political sense. We have no time for the petty divisions that place a distance between a Muslim and another Muslim. A political opposition is an immediate requirement, and coordination. Look, the Jews in the West, in the United States in particular, they have the second largest lobby in the United States. The first largest lobby is called AARP. This is a lobby group for American retired people. Everyone who reaches the age of 50 signs up, pays like $27 every couple of years, and has all of these benefits, and they lobby for causes like health, Medicare, Medicaid, these issues for the elderly. This is the largest lobby in the U.S. But second to that, it's AIPAC. That's the major Jewish Israeli lobby in the United States. And they coordinate, the Israeli Jewish lobby in the United States coordinates with the Israeli government. There's a flow of information and understanding between the two sides. I don't see why this is not possible when it comes to Muslims. If we have a political presence here, why there's not a flow of communication, understanding with an Islamic government, and this can grow and more can come out of it, provided we are convinced that this is the way to go. But unfortunately, in the past 10, 15 years, there's been the Saudi lobby that has taken many Muslims off on a tangent. And now, as I said in my presentation, some of their figureheads have realized that this was not the right way to go. And they are trying to atone for that in their own ways right now, but we can spare ourselves that and set up a viable, workable, effective, consolidated, and future-oriented Islamic opposition. That, I think, is extremely important. There's a lot of people who are fed up with the way things are run. In the United States, Republicans and Democrats, they call the Democrats Demopublicans and the Republicans Republicrats, because, you know, they stand for the same thing. There's basically no difference between them. And the average person is not benefiting from, you know, their election campaigns and all the promises they give to the people. So the time is right for the Muslims to move in. Yes, we need resources to do this, but we're not poor. We can think about freeing the $1 trillion that the Muslims have. You know, Muslims have at least $1 trillion just from the Arabian Peninsula and Gulf States in American banks. This is our wealth. Do you think one day it's going to return to us by peaceful means? If we don't begin to liberate what is ours, then, you know, time's going to run out. We're going to regret it.
Now, you said you think that we should pull our responses and stand up and get an idea and put the Muslim point of view forward. But maybe one of the things that I'm not
Okay, to give a brief answer on that, idol Muslims are the workshops of the devil, to paraphrase a cliche. The reason many Muslims feel that they are divided is because they're not action-oriented. If some of these divisive Muslims went to the war front, there's many war fronts around in Muslim countries, they can take their pick. Let them go to one of these war fronts, scare them for a couple of weeks over there, and then have them come back. Their tendencies for division will decrease, I assure you that. They may still have some of those feelings, but it's not going to be as intense as it was before they were there. What I'm trying to say is, the more action-oriented we are, then the less these issues of division are going to come about. But the more we are withdrawn from that, the more, you know, trivial issues become so divisive. I mean, trivial things become, oh wow, you can even accuse someone of being a non-Muslim for doing something, and it's very, very, sometimes unnoticeable. So, to answer your question, we have to become more action-motivated, we have to be more involved, we have to sense our strategic issues, we have to show some sacrifice, and then these issues that have been dividing us all along, they will sort of take second place in our minds.